You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, The Onion, a satirical newspaper founded here in Wisconsin, is known for bending the truth in hilarious ways. One of its founding editors tells us how The Onion can endure at a time when there's so much real fake news around.
First, White House leaks have become a regular occurrence in the Trump administration. The latest leaks fueled the resignation last night of National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, who was revealed to have discussed sanctions with Russia's ambassador to the U.S. before President Trump took office. U.S. Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin weighed in this morning on Fox News.
Leaks of this nature are incredibly damaging to America, to our national security, and we need to look into it.
President Trump says he's ordered an internal investigation to find out who's behind leaks of his phone calls to world leaders and national security information. He stated on Twitter this morning, quote, "The real story here is why are there so many illegal leaks coming out of Washington?"
SV Date joins us now. He's a senior White House correspondent for the Huffington Post. He recently wrote about leaks and why the ones coming out of the Trump White House are unique. SV, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, let's tackle the president's question first. Why are there so many leaks coming out of Washington?
Yeah, that's really interesting, isn't it? All presidential administrations, particularly new ones, have leaks. That's a given. But what we've noticed this time around is that the types of leaks are a little bit different. I mean, in the past, you have staffers who want to get a leg up on each other, you know, leaking about why the other person is not so good. Or you might have people who've been there a while thinking that a new policy is going to be just really bad, and so they might put out a leak about that, trying to stop it. This is the first time I can remember that there are leaks that go to the competence of the actual president, the commander-in-chief. And the leaks, those are the kind of leaks we're seeing now that are really kind of different. They're suggesting that maybe President Trump just isn't up to the job.
And journalists are going to these unnamed sources, anonymous sources. Tell us about the relationship we're seeing with anonymous sources. And do reporters keep going back to the same unnamed sources?
Oh, absolutely. And oftentimes we'll not try to use, you know, even a direct quote of what they say in print or on the air or whatever. We just want to know what's going on. That's probably the biggest benefit we get from them. But I think a key here is I would not use an unnamed source unless I fully understood that person's position and why he or she wants to remain anonymous. And usually it's to protect their jobs. And if a choice between making the mortgage payment and being quiet, and not getting the information out, they'll choose what's safe and hold on to the paycheck. I get that. So, you know, we try to understand the motivations of why people are leaking.
Yeah, and we as readers or consumers of this news, these sources are anonymous. There's no way of really knowing the political motivation of the leaker. Should we be concerned about this?
Generally speaking, you should try to use more critical thinking about these sort of leaks. Now, what I try to differentiate are leaks of fact and leaks of opinion. I try basically never to let people have an opinion and say this person is not that smart or just, you know, doesn't understand this stuff or whatever. But if they can give me a discrete, concrete thing that has happened, whether I can independently confirm it from that person or, you know, from colleagues or not, at least that is a tangible event that has occurred as opposed to merely an opinion. And that's kind of the line that I draw.
Let's look at, for a moment, the tangible things that came out of the leaks on Michael Flynn's resignation as National Security Advisor last night. We know that reporters at the Washington Post, the New York Times, and other outlets spoke with these anonymous sources about Flynn's dealings with a Russian diplomat. Can you explain how this leak snowballed and how these anonymous sources broke through this story?
Right. Well, the Mike Flynn one now is a kind of a different sort of animal than the one that I dealt with in the story that I had. My story and some other stories that have come out, spoke about little events, vignettes about the president dealing on the phone with the foreign leaders, say, or you know, some of his people describing phone calls in the middle of the night, things like that. Last night's story was very different. That was basically the leak of an official report that had been given the White House by the Justice Department that said X, Y, and Z, that Michael Flynn had made these phone calls with the Russian ambassador, that he'd spoken about sanctions, even though he said later that he did not, and that the report was given to the White House on this date. Now, those are all not only provable facts, but the report exists, not just in the White House, but also in the Justice Department. So that made it a very different kind of thing. And basically what it said was the White House was going to do nothing with this, and it only became an issue for them when that story made it plain to the public that this report had actually been turned over weeks ago.
So it was leakable, so to speak.
Exactly. I mean, and that's a much easier thing to nail down when there's an actual document that exists. Eventually, it'll come out under FOIA and, the Freedom of Information Act. And so, you know, that's something that is very hard for an administration to just kind of try to push under the carpet. And that's why we saw them act very quickly, starting Friday and then going through the weekend, when in cases of other leaks, they've really not moved at all.
We're talking with S.B. Datta. He's a senior White House correspondent for the Huffington Post, talking about White House leaks and under the Trump administration, what makes them different. President Trump said there is an investigation underway into where the leaks are coming from. But does he really want to figure it out? Because you could argue, S.B., that these leaks are a useful distraction to the other dealings inside the White House.
Yeah, the president doesn't need any help in creating distractions. I mean, he'll do 10 of them a day, just 5 of them just from his tweets. So I don't know if that's really necessary for him. But I think they badly want to know so they can try to maybe fire them or threaten these people into shutting up. Because most, like I said, most of these leaks actually go to the competency of the president and whether he is capable of doing this job or not. And clearly, they would prefer that those things don't get leaked.
Do you think behind these leaks it's the same rogue staffers coming out here, or is this something much bigger?
No, this is a little different. I mean, usually the best source of leaks in a new administration are those career staffers who remain behind in the various agencies and departments. In this case, we're seeing those, of course, but then we're also seeing things from within the White House itself. And now, within the White House, not the across the courtyard in the executive office building, but within the White House itself, those are generally speaking people who have just come in with the president, and yet we're seeing these type of leaks. That's kind of interesting.
Are the leaks we're reading about illegal, as the president said in his tweet? And what about whistleblower protections?
Right. Whistleblower protections will help a lot of folks who are charged with these things. There are some specific leaks that involve classified material, in which case there are very different and more stringent laws that deal with those. And those, possibly, people might be in danger. But it, again, it speaks to the discomfort level of some folks in government that we're actually seeing leaks of transcripts of the president and foreign leaders, which I'm pretty sure are not available under any type of scenario other than through, you know, the national security agencies.
I was reading the Chicago Tribune, which is reporting that White House staffers are quite fearful about being accused of talking to the media, that some have resorted to a secret chat app, Confide, that erases messages as soon as they're read. How does technology play into these leaks?
Right. Well, ever since we started getting cell phones with text messaging and then emails and so forth, I mean, it's been a whole new world than it was before you had those technological tools. These are just merely newer and less definable versions of that. Right? There's no law right now that exists talking about messages that disappear after they're read. I mean, that no one has thought that they needed rules and regulations regarding these. So we'll see where that goes in the future. Now, if you're working in the White House, all that work product is supposed to remain in an archivable form so that 30 years down the road or whenever it is, it can all be released to the public. If they're using methods that just make them disappear instantly, that could be a problem if it's internal White House work.
S.V., thank you so much for talking with us today.
It's my pleasure.
That was S.V. Datte, a senior White House correspondent for The Huffington Post. He joined us to talk about the growing number of leaks from inside the White House and what they mean for the Trump administration. Readers of the satirical newspaper The Onion have come to appreciate headlines like CIA realizes it's been using black highlighters all these years, or archaeological dig uncovers ancient race of skeleton people. Headlines like these have made The Onion a must-read for anyone who likes their news doused in gobs of satire.
Founded in Madison by college students, The Onion started off as a simple local paper with a distinctly Midwestern touch, but it pioneered a brand of quirky fake news, we didn't call it that then, that influenced a host of comedy shows, including The Daily Show.
The deadpan way in which The Onion presents its humor has led to incidents of news outlets citing its articles as real news.
Scott Dickers joins us now. He's a founding editor of The Onion. He's also author of an upcoming book called Trump's America, Buy This Book and Mexico Will Pay For It. He currently heads the Writing with The Onion program in partnership with The Onion and the Second City in Chicago. He's speaking at Marquette University tomorrow on the real story of fake news. Scott, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
Well, fake news all over the news today, and some of the news that spreads bills itself as satire. What do you, looking at, you know, from the perspective of one of the founders of The Onion, make of this weird fake news landscape we see now?
Yeah, it's really strange. I certainly don't like when those people label their fake news as satire. I think that's a cop-out because clearly they're just making up stories as propaganda or to bolster a certain opinion or to get a rise out of people who might mistake it for real news. And that was never the point of The Onion. The point of The Onion was always to entertain and make people laugh and have a satirical message underneath. Once in a while, people would get fooled and actually believe an Onion story, and that was all a lot of good laughs and everything, because those people should know better, and eventually they would find out. But we never went out there trying to fool people. Like, that was never the goal, and people who do that as their sole goal, I don't know, I just don't see the societal benefit in that.
Right, a lot of the things that really fall under this category of fake news, it seems like it's a partisan bent. I've seen left and right style stories. Here's a story that if you believe this way, you're going to accept as true because it fits your expectations. Again, something different than what you set out to do at The Onion.
Yeah, well, you know, we all have that cognitive bias, mm-hmm. and we're looking for information that bolsters our own emotional reality. And that is one of the biggest flaws in human beings, I think. And this exploits that flaw. We don't want to believe things that are true. We don't want to believe things that are empirically real. We want to believe things that agree with us. And that's caused a lot of problems throughout human history. So this is certainly nothing new. It's happening in, I guess, my realm right now, the fake news realm. And it's so funny because when we started The Onion, we hated that term, fake news. We never used it because part of the joke was to make The Onion seem real, to make it seem like real news. So to maintain that deadpan tone, we would always say, this is very real, important news. But it was clearly like a Ted Knight or, you know, a Ron Burgundy sort of character saying that anybody with half a brain cell would know was part of the joke. And I think The Daily Show was the first fake news organization to actually use the term fake news in the early 2000s. And I remember when they did that, it was in an ad or something, a promo for the show. I thought, oh, that's bold. They're actually coming out and admitting that what they're doing is comedy, because prior to that, they had done the same thing that we had done, where they played it really straight. And obviously now that term has been so twisted that it's, you know, the whole idea of it is literally a danger to our republic, which I never possibly could have imagined.
And take us back to the early days of The Onion and what it took to craft these news stories. I've heard secondhand that it was really hard work and kind of a brutal environment trying to hammer out these headlines and then articles that really hit that style of what an actual news story might have sounded like.
Oh, yeah, it's hard work. Anybody who thinks that comedy is just fun and you just sit around laughing doing it, well, actually, most people think that's what comedy is, and they always say, oh, your job must be so fun or whatever. But like any profession, any skill, you know, it's something that you learn, and it's hard work. And if everybody could do it, then we'd all be Tina Fey, but we're not. So, yes, at The Onion especially, the writer's room was always an incredibly sober place where we would have these intellectual discussions of why things were funny. There was very little laughter, and you'd have to check your ego at the door because so many ideas would just get thrown out, and you can't let your personal attachment to ideas get in the way of, well, what is empirically the funniest idea here? What's going to work the best? So that's the culture that we started at The Onion, and it took a while to get there. I think there was more fun and there were more laughs early. And then as we got more serious, you know, every week we just tried to make The Onion better than it was the week before. And ultimately, that's what it came down to, is figuring out how to make the best satirical joke about any given subject that we were covering.
Talking to Scott Dickers, one of the founders of The Onion, founded here in Wisconsin. Full disclosure, I was in a picture in The Onion at least once. You can see me as a zombie in Election Day turnout ruined by zombie attack. That's on the Central Time Facebook page. And I think I was a guy who totally looked like Chick from behind on Johnson Street. I have not confirmed this, though, Scott. I want to talk about a transition in The Onion. When I first encountered it, sitting on the floor at the Union Terrace, it was more Wisconsin-focused, more campus-focused, and over time it became more national, international-focused. What led to that transition?
I think the first year was more local, and it didn't take long for us to realize that, hey, if we ever want to grow this thing, we're never going to get anywhere if we're just making jokes about the UW and, you know, the chancellor and the governor of Wisconsin and stuff like that, because we had our sights set on becoming more of a national humor publication. So we started doing national and then international stories because we just wanted the work that we were doing to be as accessible as possible. And there's plenty of local humor. You know, you could read either of the student newspapers or the local papers. There were a couple of people doing humor columns, stuff like that. So we felt like that was just kind of a dead end to focus on the local stuff.
And the media has been changing since The Onion started. I wanted to ask you about how The Onion changed in style to match that, and even in our dumb century, matching the style of the media from 1900 up to 2000.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun in that book. So when The Onion started, the big thing in journalism was USA Today. Mm-hmm. It was like the infotainmentization of print news media. And so we were making fun of that. And then by the end of the 90s, early 2000s, it seemed like everybody was doing that. So a parody was really becoming relevant. Then in the 2000s, the big thing in journalism was Fox News. It was infotainment, but it was also this incredibly polarizing partisan infotainment. And so we created this thing called the Onion News Network, which was a series of web videos that went on to be a TV show. And that was a different voice. It was more like Fox News. It was like news that was dangerous, news that was in your face, news that was really pushing an opinion. And the opinion being pushed in all of the Onion videos was always this just really crazy, hard to pin down opinion. And then obviously the other thing in the 2000s was, and in the 90s, was a new medium, the internet. And so over the years, the Onion changed its whole news creation system. We don't call it comedy creation system. We always called it a newsroom or a news creation system. Changed from a print model to an online model so we could respond to news events that were happening like that day. whereas when we were in print, we had like a 2-week lead time on any story. So, and now The Onion isn't in print at all, so, which is very sad to me. So we created this system that is solely online focused, and the tone of it has become more of an online parody. We do more things like slideshows and clickbait, and a whole new website was created called Clickhole, which sort of parodies that BuzzFeed clickbait culture.
One running theme for The Onion was a editorial stance of contempt from the reader. The motto was, you are dumb, or then in Latin, I think it was tu stultus es was the translation.
You are correct.
T. Herman Zweibel, the ancient publisher of The Onion, hated his readers. Do you feel like, when you read, I don't want to say actual media, news media, do you feel a little of that tone of contempt that you were parodying there in The Onion?
Well, and first of all, full disclosure, I was pictured as T. Herman Zweibel. We always pronounced it Zweibel. I don't know how it's really pronounced. But that was me. And yeah, we did that because that was part of the parody. When we read newspapers or watched TV news media, it always felt like we were being talked down to, and like, this is the official truth, and you don't know anything until we inform you. And so we thought, okay, well, let's heighten that and make it this adversarial or really patronizing attitude toward the reader, which we always thought was really funny. And it goes against the grain of what any entertainment company will tell you. You know, you have to give the customer what they want and find out what the customer wants and be good to your customers. We thought, well, I think the customers would actually find it entertaining if we did the opposite, if we pretended like we hated them.
We'll leave it there. Scott, we're out of time. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Rob. Appreciate it.
That's Scott Dickers, founding editor of The Onion. You can catch him at Marquette University's Alumni Memorial Union tomorrow afternoon at 4. He gives a lecture called The Real Story of Fake News. Since President Trump took office almost a month ago, a lot of protests have taken place around the nation and beyond. So far, we've seen the Women's March on Washington, yesterday's Day Without Latinos protest in Milwaukee, and many more. Here's a clip from a protest at JFK Airport last month after refugees had been detained inside because of President Trump's executive order on immigration.
While these protests often attract media attention and make headlines, there's still the big question of whether or not they work. And with so many protests taking place, is the message getting lost? Are protesters being heard?
David Meyer joins us now. He's a professor of sociology and political science at the University of California, Irvine. His books include The Politics of Protest, Social Movements in America, and he blogs at politicsoutdoors.com. David, thanks so much for joining us today.
I'm glad to be with you.
Well, from what we've seen so far, it looks like we're in for a lot of politics outdoors, a lot of protests in the Trump era. What do you make of this?
Well, it's extraordinary how quickly Trump's opponents have taken to the streets and have engaged on a whole range of political issues. And the Trump administration has been aggressive about trying to, you know, deliver on some of its promises that lots of Americans are offended by. And they see no profit in trying to work with him, and he's offered no opportunities for kind of a moderate opposition. So people are taking to the streets. It's unprecedented this soon in an administration to see this level of distrust and protest.
Right. During the Obama administration, we saw the Tea Party protests that took a while to develop, and it took the passage or the prospect of the passage of the Affordable Care Act, it seemed like, to really get things going. Looking back, before we focus more on the present day, were those protests effective, the Tea Party protests? And if so, what made them effective?
Well, the Tea Party protests followed a pattern of, well, let me start in a different way. Obama was a conventional politician in that he set up distinct priorities for the first year of his administration and invested a lot of political capital in the Affordable Care Act. And Tea Party demonstrators who didn't agree on everything agreed on stopping the Affordable Care Act. And they forced all of their political activity toward that end. And in the short run, they lost. You know, the Affordable Care Act was passed, but it became a talking point for Republicans for the last 7 years. So there was a kind of impact, even with a short-term defeat. I'd say the attitude of the Tea Party was adopted by many Republican candidates for office, and in some ways Donald Trump is kind of the Frankenstein monster of the Tea Party organizations.
What is it that turns maybe a one-off protest or protests here and there into a movement that can have an impact beyond a big show of force on that one day?
That's exactly the question that everybody's grappling with. The question is, how do you sustain the energy, the intensity, and the commitment, and how do you spread the effort from the dramatic event, like the Women's March or the airports protest, to include conventional politics as well? So what makes it work, what makes protest work, is when it's operating in concert with more mainstream political actions, like voting, like going to town meetings, like rallying, like writing and calling your congressman. And that's a hard trick to pull off. Right now, Democrats in the House of Representatives, and particularly in the Senate, have been a little more aggressive in opposing the Trump agenda than they otherwise would have been. And I think the protesters can claim credit for that for the moment.
I wonder how much of a bandwagon effect there is if, say, during the Tea Party protests or now, if I'm looking at the Affordable Care Act and thinking, I don't know about this thing, or if I'm looking at the repeal of the Affordable Care Act and saying, I don't know about that, but I'm kind of on the fence, and then I see lots of other people out there protesting, does that maybe make me, who the passive viewer at home, more likely to join in on my side, whichever side that is?
Sure, sure. People have busy lives. They're concerned with lots of things. Everybody wants to get a good meal and spend time with their friends and study. Everybody does want to study. I hope that's true. And, you know, do lots of different things. When people protest when they think it's both necessary and potentially effective. When you see your friends out there, when you see people who look like you protesting, when you see people who look like your kids or your relatives or your cousins also protesting, it makes it more attractive and more visible, and it makes it seem like it's more likely to make a difference. You know, you looked at that State Department dissent cable just a week ago. The dissenters in the State Department have always had the opportunity to express their concerns through confidential and protected letters. And typically, a very successful one might get 24 or 36 signatures. The opposition to the Trump travel ban got 1,000 signatures. Now, it's a lot tougher to be signatory number 3 than the 700th or 800th person who signs a letter like that. It's a lot harder to stand on the street when you're by yourself than when you see 15 or 30 or 160 people yelling outside your congressman's office.
Talking to David Meyer from the University of California, Irvine, about the politics of protest in modern-day America. A lot of protests already under the Trump administration. David, looking at another protest of the fairly recent past, the Occupy movement, Occupy Wall Street and its various subsidiary branches. People criticize that for not having a focused message, maybe not having impact. I heard Senator Barney Frank talking about it, sympathetic with a lot of its goals, very frustrated that they were very consciously not getting into electoral politics. Was there something that protesters from anywhere on the political spectrum can learn from that, maybe what not to do, or is there more to it than I'm saying?
Well, I think there's a lot to Occupy, but the occupations all across the country engaged lots and lots of people, and the most of them were completely committed to giving voice to the wide range of political commitments that people brought. They were also committed to a grassroots democratic style that made it very hard to get things done. And I think that consensus orientation is a huge obstacle to sustained engagement. Ultimately, all the occupiers could really agree on doing was continuing their efforts. So when the occupations were cleared out all at once, it was hard to find ways to continue collectively. What I think lots of observers like Barney Frank miss is the people who occupied didn't just go home. or to graduate school. The occupiers fat out into a whole range of other causes. So I know that if you went to the Women's March, you would find veterans of Occupy. I know if you went to the Dakota Access Pipeline protest, you'd find occupiers. What disappeared after the occupations, however, was some sort of unifying label and agenda. And I think today's anti-Trump activists are going to have to work hard to cultivate connections between campaigns that seem disparate. You know, the Dakota Access Pipeline protests in North Dakota, the protests for reproductive rights in major cities, the protests against Betsy DeVos visiting the public schools. Well, those seem intuitively like separate campaigns. The activists have to work to forge connections among them.
Let's talk specifically about the Women's March. A lot of big numbers there. I think the organizers saw the turnout at least as a success when considering who turned out in Washington and at other smaller rallies around the country. Talk about that a little bit. How does that fit into recent protest history in the United States?
You know, it's hard to get reliable numbers, but that may have been the largest coordinating demonstration campaign ever in American history. The numbers I've seen are 2.6 to 3.6 million people on the same day, with maybe a half a million to three quarters of a million in Los Angeles, same number in Washington, D.C. And there's some academics who are doing crowdsourcing estimates, and they've got 16 people protesting in Beaver Island, Michigan. That's massive. That's incredible. And I think it reflects a lot of antipathy to the Trump agenda. And that's a promising sign. I think people will look back to that and think about ways they can carry that forward in other political campaigns. You know, when the airport protests happen, you could find people all over the country wearing those pussy hats that were, you know, the sign of the times for the Women's March, sort of making explicit connection with some sort of larger movement. So the big demonstration is like an exclamation point, and the exclamation point came early, but, you know, making substantive political change requires more than just one outburst, and we'll have to see if the activists are in it for the long haul.
Talking right now about the politics of protest in the Donald Trump era with David Meyer, professor of sociology and political science at the University of California, Irvine. Yesterday's Day Without Latinos protest in Milwaukee drew participation from thousands of demonstrators, one of many protests that's happened since President Trump took office. But will they change anything?
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you think protest is an effective tool to create change? Have you recently participated in a protest, or are you planning on doing some protesting in the near future? And if so, why? Or do you think protesters should be doing something alternative, better with their time? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation about the politics of protest in the Trump era with David Meyer. He's a professor of sociology and political science at the University of California, Irvine, and with you as well at 800-642-1234.
Join us with your thoughts and questions about protests, 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to our callers. Chris is on the line in Madison. Chris, hi.
Hey, great show.
Thanks. What do you think?
Well, I work in a hospital, and I bartend part-time, so I talk to a lot of people. And to tell you the truth, most often I have heard people in, you know, tentative support of Donald Trump. And I'll tell you, most people are getting burned out by the news of all the protests and the lack of a coherent message. You know, what are they talking about now is a frequent comment I hear. And my roommate is first-generation American. His parents immigrated from Mexico, and he is not on board with all of it because he says it's just not fair. We're all about immigration. We just want it to be fair and legal. And I think that this current round of protests is going to burn itself out and turn other people off.
Chris, thanks a lot. Not much time left. I want to bring our guest in. But what do you think? Backlash, David?
Backlash has happened before, and there's absolutely no question that the Trump administration will try to discredit the demonstrators by saying that they're paid, or that they're radical, or that alternatively that they don't have any agenda at all. This is par for the course. What we have to keep in mind is American politics gives the advantage to the defense. It's easier to stop things from happening than to make things happen. And we've already seen the Trump administration kind of encounter stalls on policy toward Israel. The Republican Congress has been divided on what to do about health care. So there are tinkles of influence already. Is it going to make everybody happy? I don't think so.
Thanks for the call, Chris. We'll go next to Joe in Stevens Point. Joe, hi.
Hi. I do not have the ample time to protest what I feel, but I wish there was a unified message that said, not my president. Just simply put, from the hacks to everything that I believe he stands for to I don't think it was actually a legitimate presidency. And anyway, don't need to get into it all, but that's my unified message that I wish to protest.
Joe, thanks for the call. David, this isn't an organization of protesters that get to vote on a unified message. How does a movement come up with that kind of message?
Well, as I said, it's easier to say no, and it's easier to organize around no than to put forward something that is more proactive and comprehensive. American institutions give an advantage to stopping things. What likely happens, and this movement is developing in opposition, is that they poke and poke and poke at the administration and see where the supports start to fall out. And you're already seeing Republican members of Congress defect from the administration on some issues, like relations with Russia, like health care reform. And does a unified message come out? Maybe not, except no. But no is a powerful message.
And David, as we wrap up briefly, what are you watching for going forward?
I'm watching for whether or not the movement is able to sustain itself and forge connections between sort of the traditional protest behavior, the big demonstrations, civil disobedience actions, and more conventional political activity, like testifying in congressional hearings, like supporting candidates for office. I'm also watching to see how sticky the protests at the grassroots are. Are opponents of the Trump agenda going to start running for school board and turning up at town meetings? And if that happens, we're quite likely to see a long period of unrest and some substantive change.
We'll leave it there. David, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's David Meyer, professor of sociology and political science at the University of California, Irvine. His books include The Politics of Protest, Social Movements in America. He blogs at politicsoutdoors.com.